Accession number 1321253, Jim Foster, Reel 4.
Jim Forrest, Reel 4.
Lots of the things that we did were not at all connected with the war. I mean, I can remember sitting in Chinese restaurants in various places around America, having a meal with Nhat Hanh and him making me perfect my skill with chopsticks. You know, pick up ice cubes. Americans like to have a glass of water with their meal, and they go to any restaurant, normal restaurant, and they'll give you not only a glass of water, but ice cubes in the water. And Nhat Hanh would find this very funny, and he wanted me to pick up the ice cubes with the chopsticks. And he would tell me children's stories and that would be told to Vietnamese children. And we would talk. I remember one evening telling him all about St. Francis of Assisi. He wanted to know about St. Francis of Assisi. I told him all the stories that I knew about St. Francis. He was fascinated. And he told me all kinds of stories from Buddhist religious tradition. He was a great storyteller. He's a famous, not just teller of stories, but inventor of stories. Because one of his interests in Vietnam was to make the Buddha more real, not a remote figure made out of clouds, but somebody who walked on earth and was a human being, not a celestial object. So he would share some of these things with me. It was quite wonderful. Today, thousands and thousands of people will go to an auditorium to hear Nhat Hanh give talks, and rightly so. I was very lucky to be able to spend a long time just quietly traveling with him and between his public addresses to more or less soak in all this.
Well, when he gave his public addresses, you know, what was the message he was giving to the American people?
The message was that we probably, no doubt, we Americans mean to do well. You Americans are trying to do good in my country, I'm sure. But what you are really doing is destroying ordinary people. You are accidentally creating enemies. Many of the survivors will become your opponents. He simply told people what was happening to villages, told stories of particular people that he knew. Just the fact of meeting a Vietnamese person face-to-face was, of course, quite an event for most Americans. The people who were on the other end of the bombs and bullets were people we'd never met, of course. We knew nothing about them. Here was an actual Vietnamese person, a monk, a spiritual master, a poet, whose poems were very beautiful, and he often read them. Who spoke English not just adequately, but his voice was a kind of musical instrument, and you could listen for hours to him talk about anything with just feeling the kind of feelings you might have on a beautiful spring day in a park. It was just the most delightful voice to fall into your ears. And his manner and his face and everything about him matched this. So I think one has to say that in addition to what he actually said, which could indeed be even academic, he knew the history of the war quite well. He'd written a book on the history of the Vietnam War. He knew he was a great scholar and could speak as a scholar, two scholars if he needed to. There was another dimension. And it wasn't simply what he said. For example, you told me that it's a pity that sometimes researchers read the transcripts of your interviews and don't bother to listen to the tapes because you miss a lot. A transcript cannot carry the special qualities that are sometimes in a voice. And I would say with Thich Nhat Hanh that would be particularly the case. His writings are very nice. People like to read his books. There are many of them. They sell quite well. His publishers are very happy to have him. But the books are a very flat object indeed compared to listening to him speak. That touched people. I'm sure that nobody could have left any of the classrooms, auditoriums, what have you, that he spoke, where he spoke without having been quite touched by him.
Do you notice that yourself, when you're traveling with him?
There were very few exceptions to that. The only vivid exception to this that I can recall, and it was a funny event in a way, a very important event in my life, I could say. We were in St. Louis. We were in the auditorium beneath a large, wealthy Protestant church in some suburb of the city of St. Louis. There had been some dispute in the parish as to whether or not this event should happen. The pastor and apparently a slim majority in this parish council had prevailed, and the meeting was being held, but there were some people who were absolutely irate that this was happening in their church. The hall was packed. Thich Nhat Hanh was standing at the microphone in front of the hall, a few people from the church on either side of him. I was at a table on the side with pamphlets and booklets from the FOR that I was lugging along, or which the local peace group or whatever it was had put out, I don't remember. And somebody stood up and spoke with the most intense contempt to Mr. Hahn. You claim to be peace-loving. If you care so much about your Vietnamese people, what are you doing here? Why aren't you there helping them? And so forth. I don't remember. All I remember was feeling I was watching somebody who, if he had a gun in his hand, would be shooting it. It was that kind of anger. It was like listening to gunshots, listening to him speaking. And I haven't in my life very often heard people speak quite that murderously to anybody. Occasionally. Nhat Hanh responded. He said, in a very calm, amazingly calm voice, something like, when you want a plant to grow, you don't water the leaves, you water the roots. The roots of our suffering are here. Therefore, I am here. And then he sat down. And after a few moments, he got up again, and he walked quickly out of the room. And I'd never, ever seen him do anything like that before. I was baffled. I don't know how long this meeting had been going on, maybe 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, I don't remember. But certainly it hadn't run its course. And abruptly the speaker has departed. And not just the speaker, from my point of view, my dear friend has rushed out of the room. I didn't know what. I of course, left the literature table and followed after him and found him in the outside of the church in the night air, standing on the edge of this large parking lot where the parishioners could leave their cars when they'd come to services, gasping for air as if he had come up from the bottom of an ocean and had just barely made it to the top without drowning. And it took him some time before he could speak. And I said, what's the problem? I didn't know he had a heart attack. I just didn't know what could possibly have produced this physical trauma. I said, should I get a doctor? Perhaps something like that. And he said, no, I'll be all right in a moment. And then I somehow, the way that it proceeded was, he said, I lost my temper. And I said, what do you mean you lost your temper? He said, that man made me so angry. I said, you didn't seem at all angry in your response. He said, no, the only way I could control my anger, he said, was to breathe very slowly. Now, this is something that Buddhists, at least some Buddhists, and indeed not only Buddhists, use in their spiritual discipline, control of the breath. I had been aware of that. Nhat Hanh had told me, for example, how to climb stairs without becoming out of breath at the top by walking and breathing in a certain way. I happened to live on the top floor of a 6-floor building with no elevator, so it was very helpful information how to get to the top of the stairs and not be out of breath at the top. But but I had never, ever imagined using breathing techniques to control anger. And I said to him, well, why not get angry? I mean, everybody in the hall was shocked by what he said and the way he said it. No one would have minded if you had expressed your anger to him. And he said, if it was just me, I think it would be all right. But maybe I'm the only Vietnamese they ever meet. And I have to show them what we can be. But it was too hard. There were so many experiences of this, perhaps not always of this intensity, but very intense, that it was impossible to think of war as we usually do in a very abstract way. We sit here, there's something happening in Yugoslavia, there's something happening in Somalia, Central America, someplace far away. It troubles us. Maybe if it's our nation fighting in the Falklands or our nation fighting in Vietnam, we perhaps even become great enthusiasts, as if it was a football contest or something like that. But if you actually know people who are, if not themselves the victims, family members, victims who represent in some real way the targets of the war, inevitably your feelings about it become far more complex, at least. You know that it's not just a football contest, and that there are real people being killed, and that they are absolutely wonderful people. They're not just things. They're not just some label. I've never been to Vietnam, but living as I have from time to time with Nhat Hanh, it brought things to a much deeper level. I've never been a political person, and I probably never will be. But what has drawn me always into peace activities, very reluctantly, I might add, is it's simply concern. For those being killed. The soldiers and everybody else. If it's for a good cause, as it sometimes is, it of course makes it sometimes just if you can't see any alternative, even if your conscience doesn't make it possible to take part, at least you can sympathize. As we do, for example, most of us, I think, with the soldiers who fought in the Second World War. But when it's something that is simply one war crime after another, and that the boys who are doing the killing are not only committing great sins, but will never, ever recover from their co-responsibility, and that they may spend the rest of their lives damaged and damaging. Being damaged, of course, by it, and doing things which are damaging to society as they try to live with this indigestible horror. Well, then, you do what you can, which might be almost always is practically nothing. You know, giving a talk is practically nothing. Taking part in a demonstration, it's practically nothing. And whether it has any effect at all is arguable. But when you just do what you can do, if you can go there and you can do something, well, you do that. If you can collect something that will keep people alive, you do that. If you can make the people who are being victimized by the war more real, you do that. Whatever you can do. And it may be perceived, of course, as political, but it isn't really. It's very conservative, actually.
But, you know, does it always go back to mm-hmm. your the religious basis for you?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, I don't think, though. We don't call feelings and we don't call our inner life religious. It's seen as being religious, and we can even describe it as religious, but it has to do with, I think, simply the activity of the Holy Spirit in your life. Because if we see somebody else as made in the image and likeness of God, this is not an achievement of our own. This is something which God has given us. And sometimes you can't help but see that. You meet somebody and you see that this is a real person. This is a kind of even a saint, perhaps. In any event, somebody whose life is shining. And it's very hard not to be impressed. And you look at all these kids being killed in Yugoslavia, and you know that they're just like your own children. And you look in their faces, and you see the terror. And your response, if you allow yourself to feel a response, well, you could say this is a religious event, even if you're not a religious person. But on the other hand, you may not. That word might get in the way.
Are there any particular poems that you know, that have impressed you, that you would like to put on the record?
Oh dear, poetry does indeed impress me. I wish I knew by heart. Maybe I do, they would surface if I had the right way of letting those memories come up to the top. I've listened so often to Nyarlathotep recite his poems. I would surely know some of them by heart after these years. But I can't at this moment do that. Surely his poems, though, did a lot to me. I later published some of them, in fact, or helped to arrange for their publication in other cases. And they're now very well known. Some of these poems have been printed and reprinted countless times. Other poems, I can't recall them clearly enough to recite them, but there was a poem of Edna St. Vincent Millay's about death as a horseman who needs us to lift him into the saddle. And if we refuse to do that, he's powerless. You know, that resounded in me, that death needs helpers. Death is, I'm not talking about the God-given death, I'm just talking about really murder. Somebody has to pull the bullet, has to pull the trigger, somebody has to push the button, somebody has to do something for it to work. And most of the times it's people who are not in any sense themselves murderous. They're simply doing what they think they're supposed to do or afraid not to do or whatever. What I was doing, of course, for the FOR at this time was to direct its Vietnam program. And incidentally, this came to involve traveling with Thich Nhat Hanh. But the main work that we did during this period, at least I think the most important work that I was responsible for, was setting up a program which we called Meals of Reconciliation. The idea being that primarily in churches or synagogues, there would be a gathering of people to eat a simple meal of rice and tea, and to listen to readings or music from Vietnam. These were the essential elements. It was, of course, from my point of view, also a somewhat Eucharistic thing. That in this case, the rice and tea were equivalent to bread and wine. Now, I wouldn't want to go too far with this, but I think it's not insignificant that we were essentially creating a Eucharistic method of communion with the Vietnamese people. The idea being to try to find a simple method to make it easier for Americans to feel touched by Vietnamese culture, and to sit at the table in a sense with the Vietnamese people and to share the fundamental items of their diet. People were free to improvise in all sorts of ways. You could have quite an elaborate Vietnamese meal if you wanted to. There was nothing; it didn't have to be just bread rice and tea. We provided all kinds of resources that could be used for these meals of reconciliation, but it was something which people could improvise with in countless ways. And there were a great many of these meals of reconciliation. I think the first one we had was in Washington, D.C., at some church in Washington, and then the next one, I think the first one was actually organized by the Catholic Peace Fellowship, now that I think of it, and it was taken over by the FOI. The Catholic Peace Fellowship had one in, I think it was in St. Mark's in the Bowery, Episcopal Church in Manhattan, in their parish hall. And that the FOR was then convinced that this was we were onto something, and this could become a major national program of the FOR to organize meals of reconciliation. And that I then went on to the FOR staff to direct the Vietnam program, and this was a central item in that program agenda. I think it was an inspired thing. We assisted hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of churches all over America and synagogues, perhaps thousands, in having meals of reconciliation. And I think during the Gulf War even, things along this line were resuscitated and used again with Iraqi food. Not on a big scale, unfortunately. I don't think any organization took over the program, but people remembered meals of reconciliation and they just did it spontaneously. Because we were always trying to get at a different level. I never felt, and I do not feel, that protest itself is necessary, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is something spiritual, where we discover that we are connected. This is the most important element. Once that is established, then simply because we are connected, and know we are connected, discover the connection that was always there, then we will, and we'll simply find ways to respond because we cannot not respond. Therefore, the thing that the church can do, the thing the peace movement can do, is to, at its best, simply to create situations in which we discover the connection that is already there. That it is not just some kind of an empty slogan of religion that we are all brothers and sisters, but that we really are connected. This is really one family. It's not an idea, it's a truth. It's not an aspiration. It exists already. It always has existed. There's nothing we can do to not be connected to each other. All we can do is to know it or not to know it, to live it or not to live it. And that, therefore, we should look for things that make us aware of this truth. And then out of that will come a sense of responsibility. Naturally, we will not want to kill these people, for example. But that's only the negative side of it. We will want to do so. If they are in danger, we will try to do things to make it possible for them to survive. And we will try to, if our government in this case is doing things which are unconscionable, we'll try to convince the people who are doing this to stop doing it. And if there are ways that we can impede them from doing it that are appropriate and perhaps also can communicate to them the reasons why we're impeding these things, we'll try to do that as well. This is where the protest comes in. But the protest is secondary. So that's what I did. I worked on that program for, I don't know, a year or two. And I probably would have continued working on it much longer had it not been for Dan Berrigan and these others who committed this famous act of civil disobedience called the Catonsville Nine in a suburb of Baltimore, Maryland. Dan Berrigan, Jesuit priest, my dear friend, much to my amazement, told me one day that he was very unhappy that nobody had done anything similar since they burned these draft records. And I had never. I was the head of the defense committee, or I don't think I was the head of it. I was the press secretary or something like that. I was one of the few people who was involved in trying to organize support for them. And it staggered me that he had the idea that this burning of draft records in Catonsville should be a prototypical action and not just a little, sort of unique act of theatrical protest, which is what I had thought it to be. And then somebody asked me if I wouldn't be willing to take part in a similar action. And I didn't know how to say no. I've always had quite mixed feelings about having taken part in this. This is another, it was quite, at the time, very famous action of civil disobedience, the Milwaukee 14. Seven Catholic priests, seven laymen, myself one of them, taking all the key records out of nine draft boards in the city of Milwaukee. Oh, I mean, talking about hundreds and hundreds of pounds of paper and heaping these up in a big pile in a city park, pouring homemade napalm on them, burning them, and having a prayer service around them while we waited for the fire department and the police to come. Well, we weren't waiting for the fire department. Of course, they would turn up sooner or later. We were waiting for the police because we were, of course, going to be arrested. We were waiting to be arrested, and then the next part of the action was the trial. Well, and everything connected with using the action as a event to communicate our concern about the war in Vietnam. So, as I say, this particular person asked me if I wouldn't be interested in taking part in another action along the same lines. And I guess I just felt I couldn't say no. And some months passed, and we had various people came together, met, had a retreat at a Benedictine monastery together. I don't know. I doubt very much the Benedictine monks realized what we were there retreating about. Sorry. Then, in August 1968, nearly 25 years ago, using large screwdrivers, managed to pry open the doors of these nine draft boards, each on the same floor of the same office building, serving the whole city of Milwaukee. We knew where the files were that we needed to find, the 1A files, the delinquent records, the cross-reference files. Most of us have been involved in draft counseling for quite a long time. We knew all about the Selective Service System, how the draft operated, what a Selective Service Office was like, what would be the papers that would be most essential for us to remove if we wanted to make it more difficult for them to force people to serve in the military. And I think for probably half a year, the draft system in Milwaukee was in total shambles, you see, after this. Well, we didn't imagine that we were going to, it was a basically symbolic action, but it had some practical consequences. We got quite a number of letters from young people who didn't go into the war, thanks to us.